And you got to keep fighting the feeling, the doom and gloom feeling. The doom and gloom feeling. And you got to keep fighting the feeling. The doom and gloom feeling.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to episode number 93 of It's Never Sun in Seattle, a Seattle Mariners baseball podcast. I am your trail guide to everything Mariners and beyond, Dustin Ryan. I'm joined by our park ranger, Mikey Ahedo. How are you doing today, Mikey?
Why park ranger? I feel like that's like cop adjacent.
It is. Wait, does ACAB include park rangers? Yes or no? That is something we will litigate later on in this show. We are joined as well by our trusty GPS. It's Day. Would you like to say hello, Day?
Mikey's an op. He's a park ranger.
We always knew it. I mean, you know, park ranger, I feel like for the most part, it's just like volunteers. Anyway, we're not going to get into it right now. And we are joined by a very special fourth member to the pod today. I didn't extend this hiking metaphor. Maybe this can be a bear we encounter on our path. We are joined by prospect writer for Baseball Prospectus and a contributor at Lookout Landing as well, John Troopin. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing well. I could not be more thrilled to be a carnivore that has wandered onto the path here. That is exactly the ethos I'm trying to bring.
Yeah, I think we can feel that. And we're all slightly afraid of you, I think, is also why I chose to have you be the bear. So congratulations. Please try to be gentle with us. Okay, so some housekeeping items up top. You can join our Discord with the Discord link that we will post along with the show when we tweet it out. And please consider contributing to the show on Patreon. You can do that at patreon.com/neversunnyinseattle. So it's been a wild ride in this last week plus of games. The Mariners took the series against the invading Blue Jays with all three games being nail biters. Colton Wong pulled off the most unpredictable home run, only to have the Mariners pull
He's
off.
He's back, baby. He's back.
To have the Mariners pull off the most predictable loss. And of course, our hearts were broken as Jared Kelnick gave us a tearful goodbye. Maybe not so much a goodbye, but a see you later. Mikey, I think you have some things to plug real fast. You put them in our rundown if you'd like to do that before we get into Mariners chat.
Laban, Laban, Laban. Fucking Philippine, women's Philippine World Cup team won their first win ever, and I'm hyped. I was like about to go to bed I was up too late last night. And so I didn't even know that they were playing that day. I wish I would have watched. But they beat the hosts, New Zealand. So I'm hyped. I'm so hyped. The Philippines aren't very represented in many sports, so it's a pretty special thing to be able to see that. A lot of them are American-born, which is interesting because the Filipino diaspora, which I was tweeting about today, is very large, but I'm so excited.
That is so exciting to hear. Maybe we can have like a watch party for their next match. Do you know when that is?
I don't, but we should. I'd be so fucking down.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. We love to support women's sports on this show, and we also love to support, the Filipino people. So, yes, excellent.
We do love the Filipino people, and as such, this isn't, strictly an event for the Philippines or for Filipinos, but we are holding, and we is really the PNW POP, the Pacific Northwest People for Profit Coalition, having a people summit this weekend. So Saturday, I think is more educational in nature. A lot of, I think, educational discussions and workshops. And then Sunday, having a mobilization. All of this is really like an anti-APEC gathering. And APEC, as I've been talking about on the podcast lately, is the Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation, which is really a forum for
ministers and leaders to divvy up the world in ways that disproportionately, you know, are beneficial for imperial powers like the US and China, and really negatively affect the smaller countries like the Philippines and other countries in the Asia Pacific. And specifically, you know, it's a really bad thing for working class people and, you know, women, migrants, our planet. So I will be there. I'll be chant leading on Sunday. It's going to be lit. So yeah, you can go to pnw-pop.com and learn more about it. Get signed up.
Great. Thank you for plugging that as well, Mikey. I'm sure we will send out flyers for that and more information that you can follow if you would like to get involved. On the Mariners side, I think the big piece of news that is all kind of weighing on our hearts is this injury that Jared Kelnick suffered. He was frustrated after striking out in the ninth inning of a game, kicked a water cooler, and has a fractured foot. It seems like it's not as bad as it could have been. He's in a walking boot, and some people are still optimistic that he'll be able to return before this season is over. But I just wanted to get everyone's feelings on this injury. Obviously, it's heartbreaking. And Meow Mix actually asked us in the Discord if we could give examples of dumb things we've done in our 20s, maybe when we were frustrated or upset, that we look back on and are embarrassed about now. So if you guys don't mind maybe exposing yourself a little bit, Day, do you have any instances that you'd like to share to, you know, commiserate with Jared?
Oh, Jared. At least he's not playing basketball. I mean, those foot injuries can last a long time. But you said, Dustin, it doesn't look that bad?
I mean, I'm not a doctor. This is just what I picked up.
That's what you said, dude, in your tweet. This is not a big deal.
It's my official diagnosis. No, I mean, that's just, you know, more so what I've heard from secondhand sources is that it could have been worse. You know, he's not on crutches, which apparently is a positive sign.
Okay, the dumbest thing I've done, I don't know if it was in my 20s, it might have been like a year or two ago. Let's just say it's like the end of my 20s, okay? I'm not sure. I usually don't go crazy like shaving my beard. I usually keep most of it. But I was trying to clean it up. I think I had some meetings coming up, and so I did a lot of shaving under, you know, the neck area. The harder parts to shave, you know? And I don't think I was using like proper shaving cream or anything. I think I was probably using soap. It was a rush job. I had somewhere to go. Anyway, it created like razor burn. And I never had razor burn like that before. So I was just like, okay, my skin's very irritated. What I thought would be a smart idea was to put tea tree oil on it.
Oh, no.
And my neck literally lit on fire, and I had like wounds on my neck for like 2 to 3 weeks, and I thought I was gonna die. I guess razor burn is technically semi-exposed skin, I don't know, and I just doused it with fire basically, and I thought that the burning sensation meant it was healing, so I left it. I just tried to suck it up. And for a month, man, I was really embarrassed to show my neck. And also I was in excruciating pain. So that's my story.
Damn, it was scarf season for Day for probably about 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's some real mom shit to just be like, if it's burning, it's healing. That's like something my mom would definitely tell me.
I think I literally had my mom's voice in my head while I was burning. Like, oh, this is good. This is good. It means it's healing. Their favorite word is it's working. You know, I was
right.
Like, it's working. It's working. Nope. Burned the shit out of my neck.
John, do you have any stories you would like to regale us with of embarrassing early 20s blunders to make Jared Kelnick feel like he's not alone in this world?
I do. It's a little bit more of a saga, though. I don't know that it will be to tell as a story, but Right after undergrad, I got a car, one of the worst possible cars that you could have if you live in Seattle, which is a 2010 rear-wheel drive Jeep Liberty. absolute dog water of a car, you know, shaped like a cube, basically, just completely meant to be driven in California, or somewhere where it's dry and flat. And, you know, it'd been in California originally. And so when I acquired it, you know, I needed to, like, change the, you know, get the title updated and do all the stuff that you're supposed to do there. And I didn't. So, you know, after a little while, I just couldn't figure it out. There was some, like, very small hurdle logistically that I couldn't figure out. And so I just kind of kept waiting and hoping that, you know, I could avoid this being a problem. And I continued to rack up parking tickets at such an alarming rate that eventually I was pulled over on the side of the road, and they just told me, a cop basically told me, you need to call a friend and they need to drive you home because you have too many parking tickets. You are not allowed to drive this car. And if we see this car on the road again, we will be towing it. So I called a friend. They drove me home. I was very embarrassed. And then we had like a little like off street parking spot, and I had it parked there, but I still didn't really know how to get this situation resolved. And so I don't know if parking enforcement kept coming by, but like they can't boot it if it's on private property. So they just put a piece of paper on it that said, if we see this off of private property, we're going to boot it. And, you know, like we're watching your ass. So eventually got rid of this car.
Nice.
It's just like multiple thousands of dollars of just.
How many tickets are we talking?
Terrible. Yeah, terrible
that shit.
Day. How many tickets?
Dozens.
Yes.
Multiple dozen.
Well,
like you avoided the boot. You never got a boot.
Never got a boot.
John, what the fuck?
Wow.
Okay, this is literally the ticket equivalent of your car getting totaled. Like.
It's literally exactly right.
You got so many tickets that you just sold your car.
That's exactly correct. That is. I threw in the towel on this. I had to pay a boatload of money because they were all late, right? Because I then wasn't paying the tickets. You know, so most of my savings just went into this catastrophe that I had like procrastinated and panicked about and could not figure out. So then once the tickets were all paid off, I just, you know, I got help from like a family friend to basically like, all right, you just have to get rid of this car. Can't be in your possession anymore. It is an active threat to your financial security for you to have access to this, for you to have keys to this anymore. So we got rid of it. So, you know,
and that's when you became a transit activist.
Exactly. Have not owned a car since. Take the bus. Got my ORCA card. Greg Spott.
Is that right? Are you lying?
Notice. No, I'm dead serious. That's the only. Yeah, it's the only time I've owned a car.
Oh, that was the end of car.
That was the end of car, for sure.
Well, this is just great evidence for my continuing theory that nobody under my current age should be allowed to drive a car. Anytime I see a 16-year-old in car, I'm like, that's illegal. Don't let that happen. They can't be trusted.
Yes, I was definitely closer to the age of 16 than I am now.
Yeah. Did you miss the part he said he was an undergrad?
No. This was after undergrad.
Oh, damn.
This was adult. He asked about early 20s.
It's worse than that I counts. Thought, John.
That counts.
Wait, this didn't have to do with an injury? It's just any dumb thing?
Yeah, basically. I opened it up to pretty much any dumb thing. You know, it could have been injury related, but really.
Yeah. No worries, John. To make you feel better, we've all done some pretty dumb stuff.
Exactly. My goal here is to make Jared feel better when he goes back and listens and realize that he's not the only one that makes mistakes in his early 20s.
I was going to say, because the other option that came to mind for me was, like, I have kicked a, like, trash can really hard, but I didn't break my foot, which I felt like was more insulting. Like, so I, you know, so I went with the car thing. I think that's a little bit better for this purpose.
That's true. I like that. Yeah, you didn't break your foot, and you also don't play for the Mariners, which is an important variable when it comes to being newsworthy. So speaking of the Mariners, we have a few mailbag questions we're going to get into before we get into the bulk of our episode. So Zach Jabal, real fast, he wanted this question targeted at John specifically, and he asks, when is it time for Ty France to go? I don't think he was super serious, but you can take that as seriously or not seriously as you like.
It's time. I'm taking it somewhat seriously because, you know, I'm not a super strong stance taker, you know, on baseball things. I think I usually see both sides on a lot of these things, but I'm not out on Ty France, like, as a player, as a person, whatever, but I am ready for the Mariners to move on. I think the Mariners have seen the best that they are going to get from Ty France. He's obviously sort of in a real gully right now in terms of his numbers. So I'm not sure it's the best time, but I also think this is a dude who's, like, his second best offensive skill is that he gets hit by pitches a lot. And that just isn't a great way to have a long-term, you know, successful, healthy career to me, especially when his first best skill is staying in on pitches that, you know, breaking balls away and, you know, slapping line drives. Like, the power's not great at this point, and he is absolutely glacial. So, you know, yes, Seattle does not have an immediate replacement, but let him, you know, send him somewhere. You can get something decent back for him. He's got a decent track record of hitting. And honestly, I think he'll be a lot better in a different home park. But, you know, I think this is the deadline to move on from Ty France. You can bring almost anybody in and at least get some, you know, show me time at first base.
I really like that take. I've been, you know, we've talked a lot about Ty France in the Discord over the past several weeks, and especially as of late. But, yeah, I still think he's a really good hitter and legitimately think, you know, he's, I don't even know, a top 50, 40 hitter. But given his lack of flexibility, given that he does get hurt a lot, I think the Mariners have for a while, been pretty inflexible, where, like, you have Kyle Lewis, you have Evan White, you have Mitch Haniger, you have Ty France. I think they need, you know, to have more wiggle room where you don't have a guy like Ty France at first base, especially because, like, I think in 2020 or 2021, they made a big deal about his DRS and UZR or whatever at first base. He's not a good first baseman, like, defensively. Like, he's maybe average. But if there's anywhere where you can upgrade pretty easily, it's probably first base. And there are players now that the Mariners, you know, could slide there. So,
yep.
Yeah, I think it's time to move on.
And I think the other part, because I completely agree with you, Mikey, like, you know, he's not a bad player by any means, but they're also, like, this winter, especially if the team is going to continue being cheap asses, like, one of the relatively deeper spots, that's a spot you can kind of stick a okay veteran and be, you know, whatever, if you're making other moves. But yeah, I think it's time.
Guys, who's playing second when we trade for Goldie?
Yo, I would fucking love to get Goldie and
move Ty over to second, guys.
Please, no.
That's what I mean. Who's going to play second when we get Goldie?
Brendan Donovan will.
How much do you hate Luis Castillo personally?
I believe it was Mikey or Dustin's suggestion that we move Ty. Ty has played second in the past.
Oh, right, it Dustin? Was not me.
You are making that up. Absolutely not. Although I would love, I mean, I would love to see a couple innings, you know. I think he could probably hack it out there, passably.
I think Ty just needs some arch support in his shoes, you know. The dude runs too flat-footed.
He does run, like, it's not, it's like a level below supernaturally slow, but, like, it's not that far below. Like, it is weird how slow. I think you're onto something there, Dave, like, he needs to go, you know, to, like, some, like, football trainer who just, like, teach him to lift his knees or something. Like, he shouldn't be as slow as he is.
Yo, I went on a jog today, and I just... I don't know why I always talk about my exercise on this podcast, but I saw a video on Instagram about like running form, and I was like, oh, I'm going to try and pick up my knees while I run. I ran way faster.
It's crazy.
It's insane.
We just unlocked Ty France. He just needs to pick up his knees. Yo, DM him that Instagram video right now. He's about to pick up an extra, you know.
Oh my God. I just hear former coaches in my head yelling, pick up your knees. Oh,
yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, what I've been yelled that. Oh my God. I was a pretty slow athlete.
Hey, did you play lineman at any point?
No. I went to a weird high school that our baseball coach didn't let us play any other sports. It was stupid. Like, that's the time you want, you know, your students, your kids to try anything they want. But nope. He literally would tell us if you went out for basketball, football, whatever, marching band, you're not allowed on the team.
I don't see exactly how that makes you better at baseball, but, you know, I guess I'm not the coach.
Ball is life, and it must be life. You can't have anything else in your life but ball.
Pick up your knees.
Zach, I hope we thoroughly answered your question. We have one more question that I'd like to get to. Do we have any tangible evidence that the M's are better at developing position players than they were a few years ago? Mikey, would you like to take this one on first?
Well, I don't know that they've gotten any better. I kind of think the question is partially like, are they good at developing position players? And I wouldn't say they're bad. I wouldn't say that they're one of the best either. Like, I think that they're legitimately a top five program for pitching prospects. I would probably say they're in the top half of hitters. And I think it's just really unfortunate that they play in such an impossible park with impossible air. And I think they have been very unlucky with guys like Kyle Lewis, who I think was going to be very good and just had a freak accident. I think he was going to have maybe some warts, like a, you know, 30% K percentage. But like nowadays, that's pretty passable. And I think he would have contributed in other ways that he can't now. And I think Evan White was a pretty safe pick to be good, and I think he's just not healthy. So I think it looks not great, but I think their hit rate has been okay. They've been a little unlucky, and they just have to deal with this ballpark ruining the psychological states of hitters. So I think that's kind of my answer to it.
I would absolutely agree. I think that the biggest change from, you know, sort of like the early, I guess, DePoto years to now is not really so much that they have developed better one way or the other. I think they are fine, just like you said, Mikey, but they have used more high level, you know, they have put more of their sort of high level opportunities into position players, right? Like they drafted Harry Ford, Cole Young, and then obviously the three top preps here, you know, along with Edwin Arroyo recently. You know, that's going to mean that you are going to have better position player prospects after, you know, multiple or three straight years of drafting pitchers with your first round pick. Like, I don't know if you put more into they have done a good job with international scouting, or, you know, maybe in the DR they have really good, you know, development down there, if you want to credit that, maybe with Gabriel Gonzalez and you know, some of the other players that have come over there promisingly, but also, like, those have primarily been the guys they gave a lot of money, right? Michael Arroyo got seven figures, right? So it's not, they're not like turning nobodies into somebodies in their offensive, on the offensive side and the farm. So I'm not really going to say that anything crazy there is happening, more than just they put their first round and second round picks towards players who were more likely to be good on the offensive side. And that leads to good players more often than not, or at least good prospects.
Right. Ironically, in my mind, it almost seems like this perception that our hitting developing has gotten better over the past few years might actually just be a trickle down effect of our pitching developing being so good, you know, the past several years as well. If we feel more confident in our ability to develop pitchers in our system that maybe don't have the highest prospect pedigree, that gives us the freedom of going out and using those higher picks on position players.
Absolutely. I think that that is very much how they are thinking about it.
Didn't we lose Mike Cameron because of that exact reason? Wasn't he like, I'm tired of hitting here?
What, because of the impossible air?
I mean, the Whole Foods near you.
Right. I think it was like the 03 season. Mike Cameron was like, his splits were so bad, and he was like, yep, I think I'm done. And I think he signed with the Mets. And Edgar Martinez, I remember he also said, he is like, he said home plate, looking at the outfield wall, it felt like it was like a mile away.
Yeah, the home ballpark topic is something that has been circulating a lot on the Discord as well. And we can probably get into that in more detail in another episode. Just the idea of trying to target hitters that are going to be able to actually perform at T-Mobile. You know, without spoiling this later conversation too much, I feel like it's a little bit of a biased overreaction to people thinking that, oh, we go out and we get these hitters and then it turns out they are flops at T-Mobile Park, and it's much more complicated than that. But Mikey, do you have any other thoughts before we move on to some draft talk?
I am curious, because I think John and I are a couple blokes who have been exchanging this on Twitter, but I'm curious, John, what I've thrown around some archetypes of guys who might, I think I would word it, suffer less than other archetypes. What are those guys that you would target in Seattle?
I think regrettably, in my opinion, just because it's not the type of player I enjoy watching most, I think it's three true outcome guys are exactly who Seattle needs to target to have the most success, right? It's three true outcome guys who are producing their offense by getting on base and hitting the ball over the fence, which is not so hard to do in Seattle relative to every other type of offensive production. And then, I think folks like, honestly, you know, Teoscar, who hit the ball incredibly hard, that, you know, to the degree where they can mitigate it, right? That is sort of, you know, Nelson Cruz was able to have success because, yeah, you know, the marine layer will work, but if you hit the ball, 110 miles per hour with great frequency, you know, the ball is still going to carry over the fence. So those are the types of players, right? You know, JP Crawford is honestly, I think he's been doing an exceptional job, but he would be a much better hitter in a lot of other ballparks where there's more land for, you know, more space for those bloops to land, those sort of soft to mid-level line drives to land and roll. And similarly for Ty France, I think that's, you know, those are the exact type of players who are hurt the most. Does that, do you think, align with what you would want them to target, at least in terms of, as long as the park looks like this?
Yeah, I think really that I think two that I've kind of said are guys that kind of like Teoscar, who just hit the ball so hard it plays anywhere. And then guys who really play to the poles. So
yeah,
I think what I'm thinking of is Kyle Seager, you know, like
Yeah.
He was a doubles machine, but he also hit a lot of high fly balls to right field. And I don't know if I quite said it explicitly, but, you know, given the park factors, yeah, I think the three true outcomes, I also don't love it. I also think it's kind of the Mariners' problem because they can't move runners along. But I think it is the fit here because we've seen guys all the time, like Adam Frazier, like Colton Wong, come and not be productive. And I don't think it has to do with the Mariners being bad at identifying players. You know, I think back to even like Zarenzik and all of those, like, trying to think of these guys' fucking names, like Justin Ruggiano.
Yep.
And
Corey Hart.
God, all those guys. And like, I think they would have worked in a vacuum and most other parks, but just didn't work here. And so I think that's a frustrating thing. So I think unless you have a guy kind of like Ty France or like Robinson Cano that can just adjust and like has strong, you know, feel like barrel control and can just, you know, hit kind of however they want, then yeah, you kind of have to target specific players.
Okay, well, unless there's some sort of drastic change, the Mariners will need to continue playing in T-Mobile Park for the foreseeable future and will need to produce players that can either overcome or adapt the environment that they have to hit in here to find success. And hopefully the Mariners were able to achieve that through the 2023 amateur draft. I would hate to squander this excellent opportunity we have, having John here with us as a prospect writer to talk about the Mariners' performance in the draft this year. I guess my first question as it pertains to the draft is, what did you see from the Mariners in terms of philosophy this year, and how did that contrast with previous drafts in terms of, you know, the levels that the Mariners were drafting at and the types of players that they seemed to target?
Yeah, I quite enjoyed this year's draft. I think, you know, depending on where you want to look for rankings, the Mariners got five top 100 prospects in this year's draft, which is, you know, that's pretty good. That's what you know, hope to get when you have three first round picks functionally. Philosophically, it was very much in keeping what we've seen them do the past now 3 years, which is a pretty sizable departure from, you know, what they were doing in the original, you know, 2016 to, well, it's certainly 2016 to 2018 period, where I think they were trying to augment the big league roster as quickly as possible, getting a lot of higher floor college players that could shoot up the system pretty quickly. You know, the biggest prep from that period of time was Sam Carlson, which, you know, made some sense, didn't work out. You know, obviously he's still in the system, but this clearly has represented them being much more comfortable with letting players germinate in the system for a lot longer. And you know, that's exciting. When you're writing about prospects, it's a lot more interesting to write about players like Harry Ford and Johnny Farmello, Colt Emerson, than it is to, you know, write about Tyler Keenan or, you know, even Isaiah Campbell, who is a, you know, perfectly reasonable player, but, you know, you when you was taken, you know that, all right, this is not likely a front of the rotation arm or, you know, middle of the lineup hitter. With preps, there's often a lot more projection that depends on, can this team successfully develop?
Would you say that reflects where the Mariners see themselves competing in the near term?
I think it absolutely does. It speaks to me to the organization feeling, I think appropriately, that they have a really strong young core that is going to be on their big league roster for quite some time going forward, right? They've got Julio, they've got George Kirby, they've got, I mean, the entire rotation and even Luis Castillo locked up, you know, like they can afford to let Harry Ford develop because Cal Raleigh's there and Cal Raleigh's having, you know, somewhat of a down season offensively compared to last year, but he's still a very solid player. So they can afford to take a little bit more time, let Cole Young, you know, have a timeline for someone like Cole Young to develop, or, you know, to see Ty Pete take maybe 3, 4, 5 years to get there because, you know, he'll still just be, you know, 22, 23 by the time he's hopefully in the high minors or debuting. And I think that's both positive for players that develop in the system and gives them more opportunity to deal from the system to immediately augment the big league roster while still having some more high level talent sticking in the system.
Hell yeah, that's an exciting change from where it felt like we've been in years past, where the pressure was on to promote so many of these players that it felt like our futures were hinging on. This is a bit of a throwback now at this point, but I think I just have trauma from the Mike Zunino situation of feeling like we're putting all of our eggs in one basket and he needs to be here now.
Absolutely. I mean, honestly, like, that is kind of how they've treated this. And you could argue, right, that's been a little bit of the problem this year, right, is, you know, they rolled with Julio last year, they rolled with Kelnick, you know, for multiple years, they rolled with Cal, you know, certainly they rolled with Gilbert and Bryce Miller and Brian Wu, but they've hit, right, you know, and, you know, Zunino obviously stands out as, like, sometimes he did, but you know, for so much of that era was defined by, honestly, they accrued a bunch of talent or people that they thought were talented, and then they just didn't, you know, turn into quality big leaguers. So because Seattle kind of nailed it with this, like, first or second batch of players they brought in, they can afford to now take some time to fill in. And I think that's really good, especially because the system's not nearly as deep as it was, and they're still pretty reliant, I think, on some of these top picks and top prospects panning out. Which is a little bit more dicey.
Mikey, Day, any thoughts on the Mariners' philosophy in the draft this year before we move on to speaking on some specific players?
Yeah. I think it's just, I mean, we've talked about it and did our own comparison of the past couple drafts, but also stuck out to me that they went prep early and then really hit college hard from, you know, like first five rounds ish, you know, they went prep and then just a ton of, I think, college, a lot of college arms, if I remember correctly. Which I think makes sense. And I think I'm just reflecting on previous years and I think the way that you framed it, I hadn't quite thought about, but when I think about a system that's developing that doesn't quite have a core yet, it makes sense to do the kind of lower ceiling, higher floor philosophy. And I think it worked for them to an extent, and that's not to say that they're not drafting guys that have interesting traits. I think I'm actually wondering about your thoughts on Kelnick and where you see him at in the season. It feels like we can't really go a podcast without talking about him. And talking to Esty Rivera, Esty was like, you know, I think it's developmental, and I think he's lost his legs over, you know, the past couple months, but I still think that he's going to be really good, and this is a development, even if it doesn't look pretty. And also just for some reason, I'm just thinking about Emerson Hancock and the thought process there. And I think it's just more of an open question, but in hindsight, it's like, you know, it wasn't, even though some of the analytics guys really liked it, it wasn't a sexy pick.
Hancock is still, yeah, pretty frustrating, and particularly frustrating because he is at this point still going to need to carry that 2020 draft where they had an extra pick and, you know, still have really, you know, not made a lot out of it. Caden Polkovich not looking great in AA. Tyler Keenan traded away and released. I believe Taylor Dollard is done for the year and will be, you know, back next year, hopefully. But, you know, you're really hoping for better from Hancock, because otherwise, you know, there's just not a lot in the high minors right now. And I think Kelnick, he looked like a perfectly reasonable major leaguer, which is so, it seems like it's damning with faint praise, but like, you can be if you're a reasonable major leaguer, it's a lot easier, I think, to have the comfort level to improve and adjust day to day than when you are just getting pounded and ground into the dirt. And, you know, really where he was at times, which was uncompetitive. So I don't know. I still really believe in his profile because I've seen him, you know, especially honestly, you know, leading up to getting hurt, there were times where he was taking out, you know, off-speed pitches on the outside part of the plate and just lashing them into left field in a way that almost no one else on the team was consistently doing, and in a way that was what made him a quality prospect more than just like, oh, a teenager who can, you know, hit the ball hard, which is impressive, but is not nearly as nuanced as sort of the rounded, well-rounded hitter that he was hopefully going to be. So I am encouraged, and I am also, you know, excited because I think some of the, you know, some of the guys they took, Farmello and Aiden Smith, who's their fourth rounder in particular, I think really have the potential to be somewhat similar, you know, trajectories there in terms of a lot of strength and a lot of other tools to be quality defenders throughout the outfield.
Big Texas Aiden.
Big Texas Aiden. Lovejoy High School.
Have you guys ever watched the Perfect Game USA? The how would you explain them? They're like
I don't know. I mean, they're just like a nationwide, you know, they do prospect scouting and also get prospects and their families to pay them money to, you know, they're a middleman between like colleges and players and high school players.
So you've seen the Ty Pete's mic'd up YouTube shorts where he just like... Dude, he's fucking amazing.
He's great.
I need him to be a Mariner for life.
Well, it's so funny that like Pete and Farmello and Emerson are all already good buddies, right? Like, I am fascinated by that as to whether that was like a genuine consideration by the team in bringing them all in.
Dude, they gave this guy the mic and he's walking around all the top prospects in America and he's like, letting people know, like, no, you guys got to know that he's him. And however good he thinks they are is how many M's he puts in him. He's like, no, this guy, Walter Jenkins, he's him. I'm like, dude, I need to meet this kid.
He's going to be a great, after a lengthy, successful career for the Mariners, he's going to be a great scout, because that's mostly what scouting is. It's just
exactly. Anyway, before we moved on, I just want to say, I said it last time, Ty Pete is my favorite.
It makes me so happy watching this video that you linked, and we'll send this video out in the Discord too, so everybody else can watch it. But I am not much of a prospect analyst myself. I do not have a great eye. You know, I do not have scouting in my future, but the one thing I do feel like I can latch onto is just like that level of confidence. And, you know, when I see it, I'm like, that guy's going to be a big leaguer. Like, I know that's it doesn't take an expert to do that. But like when I see this, I'm just like, yeah, that's what it takes. And that is literally a skill that you have to have in order to, you know, play in MLB. So
I really do think about that a lot. Like, have y'all ever been as confident about anything as like Ty Pete or like Jared Kelnick seem to be about, you know, going about playing the game of baseball, like anything in the world?
Absolutely not.
No, maybe Korean Jesus when I was in high school.
Yeah, I believe in you there. I will. It really is. I think you're absolutely right there. Of like, that is a separating factor, and you know, it's sort of ephemeral. So it's frustrating to, you know, quantify in a analytical sense. And I'm not meaning that, but it is one of the things that helps prospects succeed or fail is being in the place where you can maintain that confidence in and build on it. And, you know, that is one of the things that makes me more confident for Kelnick going forward, I guess, to put a bow on that point is.
Sorry, John.
Yep.
You just reminded me of the other guy we drafted who said the opposite thing, opposite energy. Mikey's favorite guy, who was like, what did he say? I'm not that good at anything.
Colt Emerson.
They have such different energy.
Okay. Hold on. John just said he's a very odd guy, and building on our podcast, our last podcast.
Oh no, here comes the dweeb.
Would you call him a dweeb? And after that, what does dweeb mean to you?
I think he's, this is brutal, but I think he is a little bit too muscular to be a dweeb. He's not like, he looks lean. He Damn doesn't it. Look. Buff.
John and I are on the same page.
Right.
He's too handsome to be a dweeb.
Well, okay. I'll say this.
That's teeth, not true.
Not in great shape. Which is neither.
You are the prospect guy. Holy shit. I'm impressed. I do a lot of deep dives.
I'm just saying.
I did not get the teeth.
You know, kind of. It is tough. It's not terrible, but it's not quite as good as you might hope. But I'm not judging him on that. I am just going to say, you know, to be a dweeb really is like you would fit in a locker. And I don't think Colt Emerson fits in a locker.
He definitely wouldn't.
I don't think Colt Emerson's, you know, slamming people into lockers necessarily, but I don't think he's fitting into one.
Can you let's see. Can you compare and contrast Colt Emerson and Cole Young?
You were going to say like from, and Dexter from Dexter's Lab. Absolutely. No. Yeah, there certainly is a lot of overlap. I think the comparison is pretty appropriate. What I will say is I do think Emerson has a little bit more arm strength, at least when he was being drafted. Young, you know, I saw him a good amount, or I guess I saw him last week and I've seen him a decent amount. And especially now that he's in Everett, I can go up and see him a little bit more. And he's got a long arm motion, which is part of the reason I think that people are looking at him to be moved to second or third, because either you can get away with the longer arm motion at third, or they shorten you up significantly and you just don't have to worry about it as much at second. For Emerson, I think he's just got a little bit more of that like quintessential whippy little arm motion, but there is a type here that they clearly value. And I mean, honestly, to go back to the point that we were discussing, Mikey, about the ballpark, it's really not necessarily the type of player that is designed to thrive at their ballpark. Like, they're drafting for JP Crawford's basically, and bless JP Crawford, he is a marvel, in, you know, offensively, but like this is a tough this is a tough needle to thread to be successful, you know, to the fullest extent at T-Mobile Park. So, you know, we'll see in that regard, but it is better to me than their prior obsession, which was drafting a bunch of college guys who, you know, were called third baseman or second baseman, but were actually first baseman, and oops, they also can't hit. So we're moving in the right direction in that regard.
I'm so fucking glad that's over.
Yeah.
Can you guys rank these three for me in terms of excitement? Colt Emerson, Cole Young, and Felnin Celestin. Just overall excitement.
This is the tricky thing. So Felnin Celestin is absolutely more exciting and dynamic in theory as a player, but I have a really hard time. I'm not like going to say like, oh, I need to have seen him in person for them to manifest, but like, I have never seen Felnin Celestin play a game of baseball, right? Like, I have seen video clips of him homering off of who the hell knows, you know, somewhere. And that does not mean, that is not a judgment of him whatsoever. It is purely a judgment of, I don't know how, other than sourcing from like within the organization, how you can really judge, you know, players at his age and at, like, you know, who have been international signings. So I will say Cole Young, because I think Cole Young really, really impressed me and is stronger already than I expected him to be. Don't believe all the hype about those home runs, because Everett is 357 feet to dead center. It's a tall wall. It's not that tall, but
excuse me.
Have you ever seen old Funko Field, Mikey?
I've been there. I didn't realize that.
It's a hoop. The dimensions there are, I'm not going to say they're my exact ideal, but whatever the internet tells you is so thoroughly underselling it. I'm going to just drop a link in here for you to, I'm sorry to the general chat, but I do need you to understand that there's some reasons that lefties have good power numbers at high A Everett. I watched two straight 370-foot fly balls be hit the other day. One a easy fly out to left center, and one just obliterate someone's car the following plate appearance. So Cole Young's doing great. He's not going to hit 20 homers. That's okay. But Emerson's probably at the bottom for me, just until, you know, give him a pro winter of being paid to lift weights. And I think he'll look good.
Well, there is one other topic looming on the horizon. It's kind of the elephant in the room at this point, and it's the thing that's on everybody's minds as we approach the trade deadline. John, you just recently had an article up on Lookout Landing that we're going to kind of base this conversation on. It's titled CSL, What the Trade Deadline Could Look Like for the Mariners. It was a great article, and yeah, we're just going to kind of use it as the platform for us to talk about the upcoming trade deadline on August 1st. Jeez, that's coming up. We were talking a little bit before we started recording about how this snuck up on us so fast. Maybe where we can start when it comes to potential pieces that could be on the move is the bullpen. You write in your article how the Mariners have a lot of possible bullpen pieces they could trade. So maybe you just want to intro that and talk a little bit about some pieces you could see moving.
You bet. To be completely honest, every single member of the current Mariners bullpen is someone that I could see being traded. I believe I sort of needlessly shuttled Devin Sweet off into, you know, not being so likely, only because, you know, Sweet and probably Taylor Cicedo just don't have as much of a track record of performing that, you know, that they would return much. But I do think the team has every reason to be looking to trade. Certainly Justin Topa, who they have, you know, helped tweak and, you know, just tweak enough into being a really solid start, relief arm. Maybe not top leverage, but for a team that has a couple good relievers but needs those, you know, sixth and seventh innings to be a little bit more sharp, you know, Topa, I think, could get them a good return. And then, you know, I could see someone trading for Gabe Spear, as he's been a solid lefty who can, you know, handle himself against both sides of the plate. But the big name is obviously Paul Sewald. And he is the one who I really do think, you know, this is sort of the biggest question mark for me in terms of what the Mariners are actually going to trade. Because Sewald obviously has another year under contract because of the way that MLB's, you know, payment system works. He's going to be relatively low paid for how good of a reliever he is both this year and next year, right? He didn't rack up a ton of saves earlier in his career. And so, you know, he's sort of a high leverage arm without high leverage pay to the same degree. And those type of pitchers, especially ones who aren't just a single, you know, half season rental, tend to get pretty decent returns. I list in the article Richard Rodriguez, who the Pirates traded to Atlanta back in 2021, as well as Jorge Lopez, who the Twins got from the Orioles last year, both of whom, you know, these weren't deals that got massive, you know, prospect returns, but got their club several or multiple players of potential big league impact. And certainly for Baltimore's case, right, they got Yennier Cano, who is now one of the best relievers in the league 1 year later. So, you know, it's already pretty easy to see how that can turn around positively. But, I mean, the trade-off is, one, obviously, personally, I love Paul Sewald, and I know that I am not even close to the biggest enthusiast in that regard on this here pod. But also, it's a pretty big commentary, or not commentary, but I think it's a pretty massive statement to the team, trading away a player who is pretty outspoken, not necessarily like a cross the board, you know, clubhouse leader, you know, in the same way, just because relievers have a different relationship with everybody, but, you know, one of the more vocal players on the team. So, you know, I think it's a real challenging decision that they have to make. But I kind of expect, I think I said over under on 2.5 relievers being traded.
Right. The Paul Sewald situation is such a huge conflict of head and heart, right? Agree, especially with all those comps that you listed, that it probably is the right thing to do. And it's just so challenging because he is a leader. And, you know, I think we specifically on this podcast are especially connected to him. And I still kind of take the Kendall Graveman blowback pretty seriously. And,
I was waiting for that name to come up.
And at the time, I minimized it a lot because I thought it was ridiculous. And I was coming from a much more like head place. You know, I'm not a member of that team, and so I didn't really feel it, and I just saw it as like, oh yeah, it's the right move on paper, let's go for it. But yeah, especially with the vibes in the clubhouse likely not being great right now, especially after that loss in Minnesota, you know, two nights ago. Yes, I would be afraid of that. I do have one question when it comes to returns for trading bullpen arms. Slightly different situation because he is a rental and also old and also, you know, problematic on some fronts. But Aroldis Chapman was just traded from the Royals, and the return on that seemed a little bit light for what I might have expected. I was just wondering if you've thought about this trade at all, and if you see it as maybe a change in the reliever market, maybe taking a little bit of a downturn and we might not get such a big return from trading relievers, or if it's just kind of an isolated situation, it being Aroldis Chapman and he's aging and on a 1 year deal.
I think the Chapman return is not stellar, but I do think you know, sort of a counterpoint on that was Pierce Johnson getting, you know, at least a couple reasonable pitchers in return in Victor Vodnik and Tanner Gordon. Not, again, you know, top of the road, you know, top 100 guys, but Seattle basically does not have the, I think the, you know, realistically, the only notable starting pitching prospects in the Mariners system above Modesto are Hancock and then Taylor Dollard, who's out for the year. And that's a huge sort of missing chunk, right? And then that's going down to Michael Morales, who is at best, you know, quite a ways off. So for Seattle, right, those sort of, that sort of middle area is somewhere where I think it is actually quite valuable for them to look for, you know, those sorts of players who can come up and down, right? Instead of Tommy Malone, just pumping Tommy Malone full of cortisone and, you know, whatever they like swirled around Kobe Bryant's knees for forever, just to like juice him up to somehow get him able to play until he's like 85. You know, you could have prospects who, you know, sometimes turn into Brian Wu or other decent players. So, you know, I don't know that you're going to get a massive return, but, you know, Eric Swanson helped get you Teoscar Hernandez. Yes, 1 year of Teoscar Hernandez, but like Teoscar Hernandez is a quality big leaguer. And at the deadline, I think you can get a little bit more, especially because everyone that the Mariners would be trading, unlike Chapman, has multiple years under contract.
Okay, great. Yeah, no, I think that clears it up quite a bit. And even just going a tiny bit back into history to bring up that Eric Swanson, Teoscar Hernandez deal, I think that solidifies some of our expectations. So it must be stated, and we love to talk about this on this podcast, the trio of Logan Gilbert, Bryce Miller, Brian Wu, all touched on in your article. This is kind of a very hot area of debate on our Discord, the prospect of moving one of those three. So yeah, maybe you can just speak about the likelihood.
Well, I certainly think it's a topic that is worth debating. I would be, my perspective on it is that Wu and Miller are the safest in terms of, I think they're the least likely to be dealt. They have demonstrated enough already to me to be, I think, mid rotation potential pitchers, with the additional sort of benefit of longer contract control and sort of more potential to tweak and adjust things. For Gilbert, and I have really loved Logan Gilbert for quite a while, I am a little concerned that we've sort of, he's tinkered a lot, and I'm not sure how much more tinkering, you know, he really has, just given some of the traits that he is ultimately sort of limited to, right? He has this incredibly steep angle that doesn't really serve his four-seam very well. He's really, you know, come a long way with the split change. And, you know, he's made, you know, had a couple of different variations on the slider and breaking ball. But I do think for a lot of teams, he would be a huge boon. And I think he is immediately the best pitcher that could be available at the trade deadline. So if Seattle is serious about refocusing on 2024, that's how you do it. That is how you do it. And you sign some starting pitcher to fill in, you know, in the offseason, Shohei Ohtani, and you know, have hopefully Robbie Ray coming back. You figure something out with Mark Gonzalez. You maybe even get, you know, a pitching prospect in return for one of these deals. But that is a way that you could really figure out, you know, to bring it back to Day's comment way back of like, who's playing second base, you know, next year. Maybe this is how you figure that out. and fill in some other potential holes.
Don't forget, we got Easton McGee coming back, guys.
That's true. It's important.
Day would probably have Shohei Ohtani playing second base. I think he's already got it written onto his lineup card for next year. Mikey, do you have any thoughts on the trio we discussed of Logan Gilbert, Bryce Miller, and Brian Wu?
I think zooming out, and I think this has changed in the past couple weeks based on rumors, but I think for the Mariners, if you're just looking at the season, it makes the most sense to trade Brian Wu because he's going to be shut down at some point if you expect to make the playoffs. If you trade Bryce Miller, I think it's a pretty good in-between where it's like he can only pitch so much. I think he's the most, I don't know how to say this, inferior of the three currently. And then with Gilbert, it's like, okay, you're going to get a haul and that could really change the complexion of your 2023 team and future team. I think it's easily the biggest, like, I mean, you think about him and Cal Raleigh, like they're like best friends. They roomed together in the minor leagues. I don't know what that does to the clubhouse. Again, bringing up, by the way, how dare you two on the Paul Sewald Appreciation Podcast even discuss trading Paul Sewald?
I agree, Mikey. I agree. Tell him.
We're going 2-on-2, baby. Tag team. Uh-oh. Yeah, I saw a sick and twisted Diamondbacks Photoshop of him from Zach Left on Twitter.
Who are we getting back in that?
For Sewald?
We can't get Cattell for that.
I don't even know, dude. Like, I don't think Cattell's a very good fit here.
He's having a good year.
Yeah. He ought to stay there. But I think I've actually soured kind of on Logan Gilbert over time. And in terms of, I don't actually love watching him pitch. And it's really just kind of frustrating for me that he leans on his four-seam fastball so much. Because I think with the, you know, he gets out 7.5 feet in front of the rubber kind of talk, it looks like he's dropping it. He's reaching out and dropping it at the plate. It's just really frustrating for me to watch him. And you know, he misses a lot, like arm side, up, whatever. And I just think that he could be a really good, like, slider dominant pitcher. He's kind of gotten to the point of, like, he's about as developed as he can. He feels like a Cardinals pitcher, no?
Oh, yeah. Big time.
We ought to. It's so strong of a fit that I think it's not going to happen, which isn't really how it works, but kind of how it works for the Mariners. So I think I'd kind of like to see them trade him. I also am just so nervous about Bryce Miller and what I think with the velocity ticking down in like the third and fourth inning, and then what happens with his secondaries, because they grade out well, but they're, you know, And really, like, they're not getting hit hard, but they're not getting whiffs. And so that kind of scares me. I really love Brian Wu. I honestly think Ace is not out of the question. He does need to develop, I think, a breaking ball of sorts. But same as Miller, I think the traits are there. It's just consistency. So that was kind of my long form thoughts on the three. I just, it's the optics for me that, you know, I think about with Gilbert in particular.
Yeah, Gilbert definitely does bring more of that, oh, we're really shaking things up vibe, where, you know, the Graveman trade, the team was several games over 500, if I recall correctly, right? Like, the big challenge was, like, they were in good spot, but the team wasn't actually that good. Whereas this year, right, they cannot escape 500, and they have obviously been playing poorly. Like, they've been talking about, right, Sewald had that interview where he just was like, we're playing to keep this group together because we know if we don't win enough, like, people are, you know, this group's going to get broken up. So, Gilbert, I think, would be clearly that big departure. But I also think, you know, and this is some measure of conjecture, but like any tick further, any more significant tick down in his velocity, I think could be really hard on him, because his, you know, his ability to actually miss bats is, you know, limited to his secondaries. And like you said, he just leans too much on the four seam for his repertoire.
And we got a taste of that. He was down to like 91, 92 in that one weird game, and has since, you know, come back from that. But I really think that you can just trade Logan Gilbert and get, I don't know, like, if you want someone young and kind of interesting, like Johan Oviedo, or just someone old like Rich Hill or something, and just plug it through the year. You get, like, I think we're kind of forgetting, and this is like not a guaranteed by any means, but you do theoretically get Robbie Ray next year, and you know, Hancock is theoretically closer, so I think now is the time. I would love to see a major shakeup of this team.
Jordan Walker type of shakeup?
I doubt they get
him. I wish we traded for Nolan Gorman. When Nolan Gorman was like striking out 60% of the time like 3 weeks ago. Holy shit.
I'm with you, Day. Absolutely.
We know that dude's going to hit 40 home runs for the next 10 years. I mean, he'll strike out a shit ton, but...
But like we were talking about, right? That's kind of fine in Seattle, right? You just need to be able to lift the ball, and that can work here. You know, you just scoop the ball over that kind of nice short right field fence, and you're in good shape.
Well, with the trade deadline looming, I think we all need to be careful about our future jersey purchases. If you're going to go out and buy a Logan Gilbert jersey, just have a plan for a way you're going to be able to doctor it to make it a Nolan Gorman jersey.
Save your money for 4 years for that, the 10 versions of the Ty Pete jerseys you're going to need.
So by the time we record next, we will have a lot more clarity on how the trade deadline shaked out. Depending on our recording schedule, we will most likely be recording after the trade deadline. So we will reconvene to discuss everything that happened at the trade deadline. But for now, I think it's about time to wrap up this episode. So I have been Dustin Ryan. This might end up being the last time we plug our Twitters, but if you so choose, you can find me at Dustin J. Ryan. You can find Day on Twitter at Dayshik Jr. You can find Mikey at _KuyaMikey. John, would you like to plug your socials or really anything else? Anything you're working on? Anything you'd like to send out into the universe?
I am pretty easy to find. It is my first name, last name on Twitter. It's Shitter now, I believe, right? That's the pronunciation. Go subscribe to Baseball Prospectus. You get to read me and Mikey. And also other people who I suppose are very talented and thoughtful, and, you know, just kind of be cool about the Mariners to each other, because online can get kind of nasty. That's what I got for you. That's the vibe I'll put out. And, you know, go Team Philippines. Do the Philippines, do they have like a team name, like what their like group, what their crew is called? Because I watched the game, and I know, like, you know, a number of clubs have like a specific name for their team.
I don't know. They've been using like Laban Filipinas or Laban Filipinas, which is just like fight, like Filipino women or fight Filipinos. I haven't heard one in particular. I do really want a jersey. So if anyone sees jerseys for sale or even t-shirts,
it's a good color combo. It's buy a me good one. Design and color combo.
It's so good. It makes me so happy. So donate to my Venmo, GoFundMe, Cash App.
If you would like to support the Patreon, you can do so in good conscience, knowing that every dollar you donate will go towards Mikey buying a Filipino national team jersey. I mean, that's better than whatever else you're probably going to spend your money on, you know? That's how I feel whenever I donate money. I'm like, dude, what was I going to buy with this anyway? Like a fucking Snickers bar? Like,
I just the enjoyment bought a, is like, much greater. Pint of ice cream. I should have just said that to Mikey. I'll just Venmo.
I bought the Nerds. I also ate candy. I ate those Nerds balls because I had a lot of time to kill at the airport, and I played a round of League of Legends in the new PC cafe in LAX.
Way.
I paid $20 to play one game of League of Legends. That is my new answer for worst mistake I've made in my 30s.
Now you felt like a real STK player.
Dude, I literally focused so hard on that game. I made sure we won because I was paying $20.
That's capitalism working at its best.
Oh, Colin. Oh.
It would have been $15 for the massage chair. Come on, five more for a game of League? Let's go.
Here's what I'll say. I don't. How often are you tilted out of your mind after sitting in a massage chair, though? That is more.
Why do you think I tried so hard to make sure we won? There was no way I was taking an L, raging and walking to the gate. Like, that would have been so sad.
Oh, I'm very glad you won. Oh, man. That would have been my whole week.
Well, if you have $20 kicking around and you don't happen to be at LAX to spend it on playing one game of League of Legends, feel free to donate to our Patreon at patreon.com/NeverSunnyInSeattle. And of course, join the Discord. It's a great place where we all get together and we are nice to each other about the Mariners. You know, it can be really touch and go out there in the broader world when it comes to Mariners discourse. So come in us. It's a safe haven. All right. Well, thank you for listening and go Mariners.